All right. It's a pleasure to have Chris Wood, head of global strategy at Jefferies, joining us today, Grizzle's strategy luncheon. Chris, thank you for coming and joining us here. So obviously, lots of things happening in the market right now. It feels like a blender right now. One of the questions I have is around COVID. What we're seeing in Shanghai is troubling. What are your thoughts broadly, COVID's impact and where we're going, and maybe some commentary around what we're seeing in China?
Yes, so the Chinese, by far the most important issue for China, investing in China right now is this COVID outbreak, because a lot of people, myself included, became constructive on China at the end of last year, because China's in a totally different cycle monetary policy-wise from the West. So China has begun to ease, having been tightening last year. So China is not correlated, probably the only economy in the world not correlated to Fed tightening, which is a positive. They're easing fiscal policy in China, and they've eased policy on the property market. So all that meant people positioned money in China, but there's been one problem, is that the moment we saw how Omicron works, in terms of being highly infectious, but not that lethal, people began to ask the question, would the Chinese stick with this very tough COVID suppression policy? Because it doesn't look like it's practical in the context of Omicron.
No.
So one was hoping that they'd start to relax after the Winter Olympics. But we've been getting mixed signals out of China, folks saying we've got to focus more on growth, but also focus on health. So if you're a guy running a city in China, you're getting mixed signals. And what's happened in Shanghai has been extreme. And up till the start of this year, this tough COVID policy had the widespread popular support. So Xi Jinping has generated huge political capital by having far fewer dead bodies than the Western world or the rest of Asia. So if his COVID policy was a stock, he was well into profit on the trade at the start of this year. But the risk right now, frankly, is that the profit turns into a loss, because there's a potential double whammy negative, because it's quite clear from the data that the COVID suppression policy is hitting growth and consumption. Yeah. But then there's another risk that they lose control of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is very much alive. You know, they lose control of the virus. The only good news for now is a huge percentage of the cases are asymptomatic.
Right.
And the Chinese vaccine is not, people say it's useless. That's not true. But I think the data suggests you need 3 vaccines for it to be effective.
Right. Hmm.
But they seem to be prioritizing testing, not vaccinating, which I don't understand.
Yeah, this idea of, like, if you test enough, well, of course the cases are going to go through.
I don't understand it. They should be 100% focused on vaccinating people over a certain age.
Right.
And both in Hong Kong and China, they didn't do what the Western world did. The Western world started by vaccinating on a demographic basis.
Right.
And that didn't happen in China. So it's strange. I don't understand why not.
Right. Okay.
But if we got news tonight that they were materially relaxing the COVID policy, Chinese stocks would go through the roof.
Right, right.
That's the only thing that matters in China right now.
And in the backlash you're getting from the people, like, obviously we're seeing videos, but it just feels like it's at a tether right now.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Charles. It's right. It's because it looks like, basically, if it follows the Hong Kong example, it's about to take off.
Yeah.
When I say it, the virus.
The virus.
Yeah.
Maybe further on just the political landscape globally, Russia, Ukraine, just broader picture, just when we think about, I guess this will dovetail into gold, and just how we think about the world from a currency perspective, and also just thinking about, we've talked about this in the past, just Russia itself and the motivations here, and ultimately how do we see this resolving, or is this an ongoing war?
Well, yeah, I'm a bit confused by this, because I completely got this 100% wrong. I didn't believe Putin would invade Ukraine like he did.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the motivation. I assumed he would, like I think a lot of other people assumed, that he would just take over eastern Ukraine
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and just stay there basically formalize his already occupation and then try and negotiate on for the Minsk Accords, the so-called Minsk Accords, which were agreed back in 2015.
Right.
Which were basically was gonna you know split Ukraine in two, and you know Putin could argue that you know the Minsk Accords weren't honored, and the West had continued to destabilize the situation by pouring weapons into Ukraine, which is basically true.
Yeah.
And actually, if he'd done that, I think a lot of, I mean, the Western world wouldn't have supported it, but I think China would have been openly supportive of that policy. But instead, he invaded the whole country. If he'd occupied Kiev in 24 hours, it still doesn't, it's not a sustainable strategy.
Was he trying to win hearts and minds?
And he put Chinese in a really difficult position, because no way will the Chinese publicly support that invasion. The Chinese will just try and stay neutral. But I don't believe Xi had any idea he was going to invade China. He must be furious. I mean, for not invade Ukraine. So, and now it's clearly a major error.
Yeah.
From Putin's personal standpoint, it's a disastrous policy.
Oh, it's.
And he's now reverted back to the East. But obviously, so I think the question now is, does the U.S. want a deal? Or does it, because if the U.S. wants a deal, the Ukrainians will have to do a deal.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Or NATO, anyway.
Yeah.
And, but it's got to be tempting to try and squeeze the Russians, right?
Right.
So I don't know if they want a deal at this point. I think Putin wants a deal.
Yeah.
And I think Turkey's the favored broker. But if the Russians are really doing as badly as the Western media is telling us, he hasn't got leverage.
No,
I mean, they're obviously not doing well. But
yeah, to pull out of, yeah. to the region they probably should have just stuck to, right?
So there's two, so then that raises the issue of why did Putin do this? So has he just gone bonkers? He's living in Kremlin all on his own? A lot of people say Putin's always been like this. I think that's complete nonsense. Putin's been very shrewd for most of the last 20 years. So it's possible he's just gone bonkers and lost sight of reality.
Yeah.
But my Russian friend told me that there's another explanation, that they had a lot of sleepers, you know, agents in Ukraine, and he was apparently told that the whole thing would just collapse. And the people were very pro-Russian. And so he just may have been misinformed.
Right.
And the evidence for that is that, because a lot of these people in Ukraine were well-funded, apparently the money was embezzled. And the evidence for that is two senior Russian foreign intelligence were put on house arrest.
Right. Okay.
So it may be, but yeah, to me this just doesn't make any sense from a Russian standpoint.
Chris, I'm just curious, if a deal is reached, do you think is the genie going to be put back in the bottle on sanctions, or is it kind of, have we gone too far where it's not going to go back?
It may have gone too far. I think. But I think I think it's getting harder to do a deal by the minute, by the day. Sorry.
Yeah, the longer this goes, it's
yes, because now you're getting accusations of war crimes and things. So that surely makes it harder to do a deal. I personally think that he wanted to do a deal, and I think Turkey, both Israel and Turkey, tried to broker deals. I think it gets hard. I think you can't assume all the sanctions are lifted. But I think the Chinese will try and stay neutral. But they will stay neutral. But they're definitely not going to be openly supportive of Russia. And also, it's wrong to link Ukraine with Taiwan. There was a theory in the first week that this was a trial run for Taiwan. Well, I think that's nonsense.
Right.
Yeah, you had a good note on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm firmly of the view Xi had no idea he was going to invade. Just put China in a very difficult position.
Oh, for sure. Now, as it relates to commodities, and we're going to talk more about commodities later with GNR, but assuming, you know, how long this has gone on so far and the probability that this just gets drawn out, at least from a sanction perspective, and keeps going, has this ushered in a new commodity world where whatever was your equilibrium point now it's raised higher? I put it a way where basically there's commodities for the West, which almost have a ESG type premium for not dealing with Russia, and then emerging markets get a discount.
Right, but so the issue is, one issue is will Europe suddenly decide to stop consuming Russian energy, which is obviously you can see, because you have this situation where there's a sort of witch hunt on individual Russians, many of whom, you know, connections with the Duma are not necessarily proven.
Yeah.
And yet Europe's still consuming Russian energy. So the more the world, so there is a risk, you know, there's not a zero possibility that Europe could suddenly cave into this pressure. Despite, obviously, the huge macroeconomic consequences.
And just roll into the dark ages? Like what are we...
Well, that's not my base case, but that pressure is growing.
Yeah, it absolutely is
now,
growing.
On the other hand, you've got a country like India, which has always actually been quite close to Russia. So they seem to have increased their purchases of Russian oil. But, you know, there's a risk that the US, you know, there's pressure on India from the Western world.
Yeah, and this is really the divide, right?
Yeah. Because the Western world may argue that people who increase their consumption of Russian energy since the invasion to take advantage of the situation, there will be people arguing they should be sanctioned too.
Right. Blood barrels. Right.
But obviously, the rest of the world is not really joined in this.
No.
This is a Western alliance against Russia. It's not a global alliance.
Yeah. It's if you look at the map, I think there was that UN vote of who voted. You know, basically, it's just the Western world. The Everyone else is, didn't vote.
No, they didn't. They don't think it's their issue.
No, they abstained. It's going to be interesting. Obviously, you know, we have a strong view on commodities, but it's assuming this doesn't get fixed. That's a big chunk of the world's commodities that are now stuck.
But what would send the energy prices through the roof would be any sense that Europe was going to stop buying Russian energy.
Right.
And then you do have something like the 74 OPEC shock. Yep. The difference is that this shock is not caused by a producer strike. It's caused by a buyer strike.
Right. That's a great line.
Will be, yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you have that, then you have this, I've got a chart there, very close historic correlation between the oil price and inflation expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And then inflation, if that correlation holds up, let's say oil goes to 150, and let's say, actually what page is it? And then let's say that inflation expectations goes up there too, then the Fed will be in a difficult situation. Because the last 30 years, high oil prices were viewed as deflationary, taking your money out of disposable income.
Yeah.
Which was true, actually.
Yeah.
But now with this wage growth running, and you get an oil price spike like that, and you see inflation expectations surge, then theoretically they should view that as requiring more tightening.
Uh-huh. And...
Because the argument is if there's evidence that longer term inflation expectations are being destabilized, then the Fed will get concerned about that. Because, you know, their whole methodology is based on monitoring inflation expectations.
Right. And this is on that point, if we could touch on the Fed and are they boxed in, and you know, what, how do you see the situation? Clearly they've done a 180. They've clearly got this messed this up badly.
Yeah. No, so the Fed's talking very tough. So basically, the most important thing that mattered last year, the only thing that mattered last year was when would the, if you thought inflation was going up, and if you look at the MT chart, it was obviously going to go up. So the only thing that mattered last year was when would the Fed admit that inflation was not just transitory. So before that, it made sense to own both growth stocks and cyclical stocks. Yeah, so once they, so you can see that,
Slide
chart
21.
Goes back to 1960. Yeah. So even now, M2 growth running, even though the base of where it's got it to fall, it's still running at nearly twice the year-on-year growth, average year-on-year growth since 1960. So once they admitted it wasn't transitory, it made sense to own more cyclical stocks than growth stocks. Yeah. And then the other big surprise, which shook markets in the first few days of this year, was when the Fed minutes were released. And the big surprise to me, and more important, the market, is the Fed has brought forward balance sheet contraction in time. I would have thought they'd leave that, you know, there would be no hurry to address that issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're bought it forward in time. So that's, and so if the Fed really tightens in a meaningful fashion, the deflationary trend can resume. If, but that's a huge if. Because, you know, why did they shift from transitory? I think two reasons. One, if you're 500 basis points above your target and you continue to talk transitory, you know, it becomes like a Monty Python sketch.
Right.
So a caricature. But the other reason, I think, was political pressure from the Biden administration, from Washington, because the Democrats seem to own the inflation issue.
Yeah.
Which actually is a bit unfair, because the money printing happened under Donald Trump.
Right.
But it seems like the polls blame the Biden administration for the inflation, which is why the moderate Democrats from the fourth quarter put pressure on the Fed to be seen to be doing something. So this is the first time since the mid-70s we have pressure from Washington to tighten. I mean, the market's not used to that. So the key question is, at some point this year, does that political pressure go the other way? That's what we have to be very...
Chris, I'm curious on the supply chain. If you look at some of the leading indicators in the supply chain, it looks like there is some easing in places, and that could apply to used cars, and those are driving a big piece of inflation.
But it's spreading to services now, the inflation data. You see, that's...
So there's an offset.
Yeah, but so if it gets entrenched in services, that's much more worrying from a Fed standpoint. They'll be aware of that. I mean, so yeah, that'll be something to watch out for. I think the CPI comes out tomorrow, doesn't it? I think it comes out this...
Yes.
So basically, the most important data point monthly now is the CPI. It's not this payroll thing, which we used to...
Right. So you think it's unlikely there's a cooling in inflation enough to change the Fed's...
Before this war, you would have said the base effect, Fed inflation was going to peak in March data point. So base was going to peak when the Fed started tightening, and then you would assume the supply chain things would ease. So there was definitely more of a case for an easing of inflation. Mm-hmm. I think that's from a macro standpoint, that's a key consequence of the war. It should keep this thing going for longer. Then you've got the risk of a more geopolitically aggregated by, you know, the Europeans. So the Fed can't be... So the consensus now is more like CPI being 4.5 year end, whereas, but I would say before the war it was 3. Mm-hmm. But even 3% of... Yeah.
Yeah, so now there's a political will, and the Fed has already been behind the ball, so now they have to start moving.
But at the end of the day, I have a hard time. I would call meaningful tightening, raising the Fed funds rate to 3% and shrinking the balance sheet from 9 trillion to 6 trillion, which is where it was before the pandemic.
So you don't see it above 3%? Like that, like 3% where you see it?
No, I think that's meaningful. I'm saying that's meaningful.
Yeah.
Now, if you're Miss Professor Taylor of the Taylor rule, you would say should get higher than 3%.
Right.
But he's got a rules-based approach. The reality, the Fed hasn't got a model. The Fed is operating without it's got no model.
Yeah.
It's making it up as it goes along because its previous model has blown up. They had a 2-year strategic review where they announced that inflation was over. They dispensed with the Phillips curve. And they gave themselves license to overshoot 2% because of this concept of average inflation targeting.
Right.
Which means to make up for all their undershoot, they could overshoot. But inflation is now so high, all that slack is now gone.
Right.
So actually, they haven't got a model anymore.
Just winging it.
They're winging it. And the most, obviously, Powell's a lawyer, so he just does what he's just managing a consensus.
Yeah.
But the vice chair, he took his cue from Clarida, who's now retired. So the new vice chair is this lady, Brainard, who would actually be the Fed chair, but they weren't sure they'd get the votes. So she was a very articulate dove last year. She was a big dove, but she gave this speech last week basically saying, you know, we've got to address inflation. So. And that's why the market, and then they came up with the Fed minutes with more details on the quantitative tightening. So the markets can be very sensitive, but it looks like they're going to be trying to shrink the balance sheet by about a trillion a year based on what they... So, you know, this is the meaningful...
And your thoughts on the yield curve inverting and it just...
I think the real inversion is Fed funds 10-year Treasury yield.
Okay.
The market's focused on 2 and...
Yeah.
But I think the real... I think for now, the economy that's really... The U.S. economy is going to be much more resilient than Europe. Also, you see, Asia gets hit by imported energy. But I think one should assume that you'll start to see material evidence of a slowdown by Q4 here. But the reason I think the U.S. economy is not going to roll over immediately because there's strong wage growth. Though I have to say, you really do notice the prices in America compared to Europe. I mean, you really notice higher prices here. That's what I have to say.
Yeah.
Really do.
Yeah, so are there changes you see this?
But the low end of the labor force is getting wage growth, right? So that's a big change from...
Yeah.
Yeah. From the consumer balance sheet point of view, are there differences this time than 08?
I think the consumer's in a better position, right? Because the consumer was already saving more post-2008 because of the shock. And then also the U.S. households, like other G7 households, have been massive financial beneficiaries of the pandemic. That's why we have the inflation.
Yeah.
The supply chain bottleneck is the aggravator. The key driver of the inflation is that a lot of people paid money to do nothing, which stimulates demand. I can assure, the reason we even got inflation in Asia like that, because no one in emerging markets, it's not like Chinese or Indians were paid money to do nothing. It just doesn't happen.
No checks in the mail. It's
So it's a fundamental difference in approach. So that's why I had a big position in Chinese government bonds.
Right.
In my global sovereign bond portfolio, I have a 60% weighting Chinese 10-year. So actually, China lends itself.
What's the Chinese 10-year at?
Maybe about 2.78.
Yeah. 2.78, yeah.
They could well cross with the US 10-year.
Yeah, sure.
No, it's, when I did this, 2.79.
2.79, right.
So my global sovereign portfolio is, I would have it 100% in China, but it's a bit extreme. So I have 20% in the Indonesian 10-year, 20% in the Indian 15-year. So I started this portfolio to March 26, 2020, because I said you should sell all G7 government bonds when I saw this policy response to the pandemic.
Right.
So my portfolio, as of a week ago, is outperforming the G7 government bond index. My portfolio is up 20.5%. G7 government is down 4%.
Okay. We need to make that into an ETF.
Yeah, but you'd have a trouble accessing. But the reason the bond and the foreigners have been buying Chinese government bonds because they have a more orthodox policy, and that's why the renminbi is stable. So actually, the best way of hedging Chinese equity exposure is to own Chinese government bonds. The risk in China is the stocks are cheap, but the growth, this.
Is there any way to function? Like, is there a?
It's a close. There's a bond connect in Hong Kong.
Okay.
That's how you invest in Chinese.
Because I'm trying to think. Is there anything in America ETF? No, probably nothing. Right. This is a very fascinating. Now
yeah, it's basically. It's for institutions.
The good returns. Chris, obviously, we're close to the whole broad growth, growth stocks, and it's been an incredible sea of carnage, right? Bigger picture, you talk about FANG here, Facebook, Amazon, the FANG stocks, and then also. Let's call it the ARK stocks. And you could throw biotech in there as well, but it's been carnage on the one side, Cathie Wood's strategy, and then and plus, like it's a lot of these stocks are down 70-80%, and then obviously FANG has held in, there's been hurt there as well.
Yeah, but so what hasn't happened yet in this sell-off, what's been amazing is when I last checked, there's been no net outflows out of US domestic equity ETFs.
Right.
That's an amazing fact. Huh. So it would be odd if this monetary tightening cycle doesn't lead at some point to domestic flows out of ETFs, because then obviously you get forced selling as opposed to discretionary selling.
Right.
But the most important thing this year is does the Fed change tack again? So I think we have to be sensitive to the political things, not just the data.
And that political change of wind,
yeah,
will be very, growth stocks will be very sensitive.
Very
to that.
Sensitive to it, incredibly sensitive.
Right. It's your thoughts on just the Cathie Wood, some of the are. Do you think that sector, some of the more extreme areas, and we'll talk about it more on our side, but do you think what's interesting is there's been no outflows from her fund either?
No, and there hasn't been from the aggregate.
Yeah.
There's been outflowing from bond funds, but not from domestic. No, it's incredible.
Yeah, you'd think she'd be the canary. I would think she'd be the canary in the coal mine for the equity outflows.
Do you think so?
Well, they could be.
The investors in that fund are sitting on larger losses than many other.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, I think we need to be very. But if I told you the ARC would be done as much as it's done, you would have assumed there'd been outflows already.
Yeah. That's one of the we
the
also
belief is still there among the investors in the fund. The belief is
still there, without a doubt.
Yeah.
A lot of these themes are real solid. You know, they do have long duration themes, but it's just a function of the valuations.
Yes, pricing pay. Yeah. We'll discuss.
Now, bigger picture, beyond global bonds, you're thinking around where should investors be positioned from an equity perspective. I've also got your Asia ex Japan, which has done incredibly well, but I think more bigger picture too.
To me, the value in cyclicals you want to own, but obviously at a certain point, the cyclicals will become vulnerable because of the economy slowing.
Sure.
So this is the issue. But look, if I owned only one cyclical sector, it would be energy. And the risk in energy is simply you get a deal on Ukraine, then the oil will fall sharply, and then that's the opportunity to add to buy energy stocks you should have bought already.
Yeah. And we've already seen a pullback in oil, right? Like it's back pre-war.
Yeah, but I think that partly China-driven. So the other point about oil, we've got this.
Right.
Yeah, because oil's had this big rally with China being closed. So where would it be if?
Yes.
And the best market long term in Asia, although it's going to have correction, it's going to have monetary tightening headwinds this year, is India. Okay. But that's not a cheap market. No. So we had record foreign selling of India last quarter because the foreigners basically were taking money out of India, which had already done very well last year, and put it into China because China looked very cheap for the reasons I said.
Yeah.
But then that's gone wrong so far because of the COVID suppression policy. And India held up despite record foreign selling because of very strong domestic mutual fund flows.
Right. And your Asia ex Japan has done, these are like incredible. So I think you've got your 3,000 versus.
But that's since the long term, yeah. So that,
yeah, but this is the one you're known for.
The biggest part of that performance, I would say, the last many years is India.
Is India okay? Yeah. That was the question. So what we got here is a graph of this long only portfolio. You've basically you do a rebalance. Like, is it quarterly or quarterly rebalance?
Yeah.
And
I might move a few things around. So. But right now, where this portfolio is having its up, India and the resources worked, it's China.
Right. Okay. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, everyone, welcome back. It's a pleasure to be here with Mitch Berukowitz. He's the founder of Merida Capital Holdings. I'd say Merida, they've been investing in cannabis longer than almost anyone, and they're probably the most diversified fund that I've seen in just geography and types of businesses. So we're excited to talk with him about the sector. Mitch, I want to start things off. Are you frustrated with the situation in cannabis politically, or do you think that there's still, returns to be made and things can happen without legalization in the U.S.?
That's an incredibly layered question.
Yeah.
From one perspective, I think anyone who's been in cannabis for a while has started when there was no regulation, there was no prospect of a federal legislation. So you've learned, if you're smart, you've built businesses, like a fund like ours that has a very diversified approach, building businesses ourselves, investing in other businesses, supply chain, production, manufacturing. everything from data to analytics. So we've tried to build the portfolio in a way that is unfrustratable. However, it is frustrating to watch the momentum surge and have, especially the U.S. stocks can't trade on the bigger exchanges. So watching them get pummeled while the operating performance has virtually spiked,
yeah,
is one of the bigger frustrations, because it does affect sentiment, which affects valuations, which affects capital flow. And right now, cannabis is truly about money flow, right? Money flows into ETFs. They downstream that into public companies, which helps float the public companies before institutions can come in. So you have this very strange dichotomy where operating performance for almost every portfolio company in our portfolio, and just public companies in general, has really rocketed in the last 2 years, but money flow has now stopped, right? ETFs aren't seeing inflows. I know that every time someone talks about the MORE Act or the STATES Act or any other bill, the CAOA, that interest spikes up, you see money flow into ETFs. Yeah. So you can see how much latent money it is.
Yeah.
So it is frustrating to watch money flow stop, start, stop, and start. I think it's and it makes it difficult to predict, which puts stress on the entire ecosystem of cannabis generally. Yeah. Right? Unpredictability is a killer of business growth.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So this is the public market we're talking about. I'm curious to hear from you what's the state of the private markets compared to, you know, now versus 2 years ago? Like, kind of, what are you seeing? Is this bleeding into the private markets at all?
Well, it's hard for sentiment to be completely compartmentalized into the public market or the private market. So when we think of when we talk to companies, depending on what they're in, there's no more hype. So it's really about what they're doing and how they're servicing companies downstream, especially private companies typically are service oriented. And so when you think of ancillary companies who are growing, still growing 100% a year, but now things are delayed because public companies pull back, spend a little less, are managing their cash flows a little more carefully. So that means M&A is going to be slower. That means the use of private services is going to be slower. That means adoption of innovation is going to be slower. So it really does radiate downward into the into the private companies very quickly. And after 2 years, or really a year of kind of a carnage on the public markets, what you've seen is a distinct operating focus of most private companies making sure they're reserving cash. So it really does stop innovation a little bit. But I think the most exciting thing about the space is that because institutions aren't in there, companies like us can navigate kind of and pick and choose what we want to do. So typically that's why we often say we're not worried about companies right now. We want to be in certain areas of the space. And that's why the last couple times we've spoken, I talk about areas rather than specific companies. Because on the private side, if you're, you know, relatively diligent and go through the work and have been in it a while and understand ecosystem development, connectivity, and how the cannabis space is all interconnected, which is so rare in an industry where, you know, 50, 100, 150 companies matter. You know, that's a huge barbell. And so we're in a place where we can really diligence those companies and pick and choose. But so if you've done your work, you should be in a place where you know the areas that are growing disproportionately. Not as concerned of picking like the one winner, because there isn't going to be one winner. Mm-hmm. There's going to be 5 or 7 companies that really dominate, whether it's, you know, clean cannabis technology, lab testing, downstream, internal testing, precision equipment. When you look at those, we don't see like one dominant player, which is why some of the valuations on the tech side have gotten quite ridiculous, mm-hmm. because there isn't going to be one company that dominates the digital desktop.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's not like Fang or Apple.
From a valuation perspective, if you look at the top like 20 companies in cannabis, whether it's ancillary or otherwise, right, the biggest private one would be Dutchie, and then on the public side, I think it's Curaleaf. If you look at them, I mean, the top 10, 15 companies on those sides do dominate. It's still barbelled pretty hard mm-hmm. to the bigger companies.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's 100 companies that are of equal value. There's 15 to 20 companies that are valued over $1 billion, and then there's everyone else.
There's one thing we've noticed going through the ETF route. There's been institutional money on the public side pulling back, it seems like, even more in the last year. I'm wondering if you've seen that from, you know, LPs and just the money moving into the private markets. Has there been even more of a pullback than there already was the year before that?
Yeah. Well, I think Chris touched on something which is really important, which is the feeling of opportunity cost of your capital. So if you're in a public company on, you know, any public company in the cannabis side that's large in the U.S., like Trulieve or Curaleaf or Cresco or GTI, you have to value if there's no regulation, where is it going? And I think there's just this perception that these can't move without a regulatory change that unlocks institutional capital. Like, the retail's not going to be big enough to move it. So when you look at that opportunity cost, first you had a market where, again, operating performance has nothing to do with opportunity cost or anything. But if you're only focused on stock movement, then where can a stock go when an overflow of capital can't happen, right? Like I said, we at Merida almost a year ago said the only thing that matters to public companies is money flow. It doesn't matter whether they're winning or losing. It doesn't matter market share. You can understand the CAGR and where, like, all the MSOs operate in markets that are pretty easy to define: the demography of the people, the shifting consumer, which we spend a lot of time on data. And then when you look at that shift, so you can predict it. But if you predict it, but the money flow doesn't follow the predictions of these bigger growth factors, stocks aren't going to move.
Yeah.
So people now, when I talk to people at JPM and Morgan Stanley, and they talk about their interest in it, they say the problem is they feel like there's a lot of opportunity cost to putting capital there given the volatility in other places. So it's almost like a trader's market in an industry that really needs an investor mindset because of the just what happens on the day-to-day, the week, you know. Cannabis has to be invested and it can't be traded really well.
That's an interesting way to put opportunity costs, because you do have growth rates are slowing among at least the big private guys. And so in this type of market, you can see other companies that may be seeing better growth. And so investors have to weigh that.
But you also have to think about imperfect articulation of the cannabis thesis. What can you really trade right now on the public side? If you're let's say you're wildly interested in cannabis and you want to be active as a trader, you can articulate a state-based, most traders aren't willing to do the work and understand every state's relative rate of growth. Like, if you looked a year ago or 2 years ago, I don't know if you guys read the commentaries we put out, but we talked about who the biggest user of retail consumer data, and I mean retail, meaning people walking into stores, foot traffic, is BlackRock, right? They are looking, they know where to have their money before quarterly earnings because they've looked at foot traffic, and they're not worried about what they feel like they can predict a company's earnings based on how many people walked in that store, what they spent per bucket size. So they're buying all this private consumer data. That's kind of what we do. So when we look at the public side, we can predict pretty well relative rates of like where a company's gonna end up in earnings, what those ranges are. But it doesn't matter if money doesn't flow behind it.
Yeah.
And that's why on the public stocks, you're buying something that you're hoping can move, but hope isn't a great strategy. So if you're trying to trade it, what is your articulation? It's public companies. Again, which require a lot of work to understand how they're going to report. That's a lot of work to figure out how Cresco's going to report.
Yeah.
You have to understand state-level dynamics, which is a lot of work. So traders aren't really putting in the time.
No.
So what are traders doing? They're trading on sentiment. And sentiment right now is, I don't have to do anything. So cannabis isn't the place you're going to be if you're an active trader. Mm. It's not a meme stock. I mean, Tilray is kind of a meme stock.
Yeah,
But I'm just saying, that's why it moves so much. You know, every time the U.S. Says something on regulation, Tilray and Cronos and Canopy move.
Yeah, it's not the U.S.
And,
ones.
And they move faster.
And I think Irwin Simon's, by the way, very savvy in constantly talking about the U.S., even though there's no way to have like a thesis on the U.S. if you're a Canadian company just yet.
Yeah.
You might have an idea and a strategy, but you don't really have a thesis.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about, I was reading that some states are trying to increase banking access on their own. They're saying we're going to do it even if there's not national. Does that matter without national legalization, really?
Okay, so I think everything I'm saying is feeding into the same funnel, which is on public stocks without a federal movement, you're not going to have the money flow for a tidal wave of stock movement. However, there are people, what you start to see, and this is how typically, you know, stocks move. You guys know this. And from my early days as kind of a trader in the 2000 year when internet stocks were crazy, I think what you start to see early adopters say something is going to change. And so they'll make a bet. And then that gets stocks moving a little bit, right? That creates a little bit of an inflection point towards buying. And so in a market where really it's not that there's such heavy selling, it's really just a buyer strike right now. Mm-hmm. So if you get some buying going in, you're going to have one-way volume. People get interested in it. And the federal government seems like 2022 has to be a year where something gets done. I mean, I think at worst, when we scenario analyze the 50 ways that regulation can move in the United States, I think the biggest thing we think at worst is a lame duck. The Democrats get killed in the midterms and use the lame duck to just finally say, you know what, this is a good time to do it. We're going to lose power. We don't have this as an issue anymore. You know, because I think anyone comfortably predicting, I think the Democrats are looking to lose at least 30 seats in Congress.
So they do that before they lose?
Well, no, they're going to lose. Well, but it's true, but for some reason, it seems to me like the political, the really interested political stakeholders are very narrow in the United States. You know, you have guys like Rep. Blumenauer and Dave Joyce and AOC. They talk about it. But really, the people that are doing it, Blumenauer is doing something constantly. Dave Joyce, who's a Republican from Ohio, is doing something constantly. Schumer tweets about it constantly, but doesn't really do anything. Yeah. He killed two bills already, or killed the Safe Banking Act.
Yeah.
So states don't really need to do much. There's already banking at the state level. All of our state-based operations have banking, right? Whether it's credit unions, but trading securities requires a paradigmatic shift in regulation.
Yeah.
And I think that's what gets people excited, because if that happens, there's going to be, there'll be a seller strike. And when you have a lot of institutional money coming in and a seller strike,
very low volume,
right? And very low volume. So, because people aren't going to wait for these to uplist to NASDAQ. If you're an institution and they change the rules, let's say it takes everyone 6 months to uplist. I know that people have made a big deal about some of the S1s, or they're really kind of like S10s that have been filed.
Yeah.
You can't just uplist the next day. There's at least a 30-day period of review. It's really probably like a 60 to 90-day at minimum for anyone big. And so, and having gone through the SEC registration ourselves at the fund level, I can tell you the cannabis gets a little bit more scrutiny than everything else. So you're looking at a 90 to 120 day window, but there are going to be people, if you
is
know,
like
it's
a smart institutional money that gets in.
Absolutely. Long. So there's going to be a massive bid right away, and then it'll lull out a little bit. But I think when things start to finally roll over and people start thinking about, think of the funds, whether they're index or otherwise, that are going to have to buy cannabis, right? You're talking about retail. Right, specialty retail stores. So, like, you let's say you own Bass Pro Shops and other sporting goods. Well, this is a new category of stores that you can buy.
Yeah, it starts showing up in the
indexes. Specialty retail, consumer, medical, bio, pharmaceutical. So there's a lot of different ways where money can flow in. And once that money flows in, then what happens typically is, because there's a narrow articulation, in order to broaden the articulation, you're going to find more public offerings. Which is, that's why we're excited by whatever happens. People on Twitter like to throw, you know, zingers at each other about which bill they back. But I constantly say, I'm agnostic. The truth is, a broader public, more transparent market means more opportunities for good companies that have had to really, really dig their way in the private markets. I mean, the companies that are operating in the private markets in cannabis that are really getting somewhere on their growth have really become good operators at swimming upstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the easy days are over, not, where you can just throw
it's absolutely
money at
difficult
the
and it's competitive.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of entrants that, you know, typically entrants now are better funded. You very rarely do you get like a deck that has no money behind it. It has to at this point. And usually it's an established entrepreneur. So there's this cycle that you see in other, you know, we saw it in ad tech in 2008. You saw it a little bit in sort of fintech around housing in 2014, 15. You know, out of crisis comes innovation, then better funded innovation, then optimism, and, you know, you can, you know, the curve of that they show, you know, early adopters, and
yeah.
So we're almost at you know, at square one again in cannabis.
Yeah, yeah.
But the operators are getting better. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to get to the meat and potatoes here. Can you talk about some of the areas of cannabis that you believe still can generate the most attractive returns, maybe less followed verticals? Seems like that's your bread and butter. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think is the next
thing? Yeah. Like I said, we try to take a very broad-based view of how to construct a portfolio that is both well-diversified but has that alpha. So obviously one area is the state-based licensing, which I think we're the only really pure financial company that has an operating arm that can, you know, really engage in that state-level licensing. Successes in Missouri, West Virginia, and other places really help that. So I think on the state licensing side, still understanding those state-based opportunities and doing that. But the real broader areas where I think people should be looking are companies that touch the medical side. I think it's a very simple equation, right? This is what we consider at Merida the Pythagorean theorem of cannabis investing before Pythagoras existed, right? Because the theorem itself just proves something that already must have existed in nature.
Yeah.
And the pure answer is, people are using this medically. They might be self-medicating. They might not want to get a medical card. But people are medicating. If you look at the usage reasons why people might use, even consumers admit that some of it's for relaxation or mental health or, you know, sleep, pain. But when you look at how much people are engaging and consuming, you start to think that doesn't just look like a consumer, you know, drinking one beer at the end of the night.
Yeah, it's very.
It looks real consumer, exactly, and the heavy user. So you know, as we spoke about, I think the last time, is that skew of heavy user really coming to the market shows that people are looking for more powerful products that have a label and that says this is how much THC is in it, because they understand that for them to get the relief they need. So I think the medical side, and here's the unlocking of that theorem. So A squared, right, is the fact that with governments, you already see loosening at the federal level on DEA research or DEA approved research. So with research comes validity to the broader medical market, doctors, other stakeholders, people that write journals, right? And you're going to see the research, because the research is being improved at a more, with more velocity now. Mm-hmm. And no one's against medical research. There's not one person you find who's like, you shouldn't research cannabis. So you have that. So more medical research means more validation. More validation means more attention and more doctors looking at this as just another arrow in their medical quiver. At a time when toxic medicines are being completely removed from holistic medicine. So you have this really strange, more holistic medical industry looking for more non-toxic alternatives at a time when not medical marijuana, but cannabis-based medicines are going to be on the rise.
Yeah. Right.
And I think when you look at those two things, that spiral leads to a tremendous amount of medical approach. So for us, we're looking at tools that educate doctors. We're looking at medical card issuance. We're looking at medical data. Mm. You know, those are the investments we're making now on the private side. And there's a few ways to scrape it on the public side. Anebulo was a company that we recently did, which they make a molecule that's going through phase two right now that is for acute intoxication. So that's actually one of the guardrails. We think that with more yeet consumption comes, you're going to need better regulatory guardrails and better. So it's like an EpiPen, hopefully. If the molecule proves out, it'll be, you know, 20 minutes, you take it, and you've reduced the intoxication so that the person no longer has THC coursing through their system. And we think that's important, because even if we don't necessarily believe that you can, quote unquote, overdose on cannabis, the reality is, from a mental health and from a how you feel inside, if people consume too much, it is an incredibly uncomfortable feeling at best.
Yeah.
And we think with kids, you know, being exposed to more legal cannabis, this is a good thing for schools and other things to have. But we're not saying that the stock's going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Like other stocks, it doesn't really move. But it's more of a biotech play. But we do think that you'll find that if you work hard, you can find some articulations that are outside of growers. And, you know, on the ancillary side, we always talk about GrowGen, Hydrofarm. Scott's Miracle-Gro just made another acquisition that's further bigger. I don't know if you saw that they also put money into Rivers, Canopy Rivers.
Yes.
So Scott's Miracle-Gro is now becoming a very cannabis-focused company.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's definitely opportunities in the picks and shovel, which is like your bread and butter. If you had to guess how you think the medical, actually, like FDA avenue shakes out, are any of the current players really going to be winners? Or is it really going to be the guys we know that do the research? They're just waiting and they're going to come in and run it.
I'd hate to say that there was a myth in the 2016, 17, 18 that's been proven to be false, because we were against it, but people had this idea that like the MSOs or like the Canadian companies were going to be research organizations.
Yeah.
And I think what's been proven is that actual researchers coming into space enough where they could be partnerships, but I don't think you're going to find a lot of the MSOs to be focused on sort of unlocking the medical paradigm, simply because it's very resource intensive.
Yeah, it's expensive.
And it doesn't necessarily drive the CAGR of, like, if you're in Illinois, you know, if you're Cresco or GTI and you're heavily in Illinois, the medical research does nothing for you today. And I think that's one of the interesting elements of having a lot of these companies be public, which is they start to manage their companies different in terms of where they're putting capital, right? It's very rare you're going to find an MSO taking a minority position in a company nowadays, because you can't consolidate the balance sheet or the earnings. So they are really locked into majority positions in state-based operations. That's what they have to do.
Yeah, the time horizon.
The time horizon, right?
Yeah.
So you know, if you look at early MSO activity outside of their core, a lot of them were making investments in brands. You know, it might have been small, but like when you think of a GTI acquisition of a Bebo, as an example, when's the last time you saw an MSO buy like a brand per se? They may partner with that brand, they may license it, but you really haven't seen any of that. And I think one of the reasons for that is really because they're building their brand in their look. The brand doesn't build their growth today, right? The branding matters when the volume is so high that the way to move your needle would be to bring brands on and to drive that interest. I don't think you see that. And also, they think about it, what's better, to own the dispensary and serve your own dispensaries, or to own just one brand on a shelf? So they're much more focused on the broader opportunity of building volume through their channels.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, so that articulation, and then there's other ways. If you really, you know, dig deep, you'll see other biotech companies that are now doing cannabinoid-based research. I think you see some biotech companies or healthcare companies starting to think about it. I always talk about insurance reimbursement. Find the first insurance company that's going to unlock the U.S. from an insurance perspective. They're going to have subscribers because people are going to want non-toxic alternatives to their in their medical opportunities set. And I think that's an important thing. And then with that, you look at formulations that that insurance company may want specifically for. They're not going to want you buy an ounce. They're going to want medical formulations.
Yeah, and they want it the same every
right.
time.
Right. So it really. So what we try to do is to unpack that linearity and that connectivity, and try to look at what are the gaps that we know we can invest in with confidence. And that's why, you know, sometimes we do end up in public companies through a private, specifically for that reason. We're buying something or into something that we know fills a gap.
Got it.
We love inevitable growth. And so the other area that we think is just completely either misunderstood or it's just not sexy enough is the advertising technology side, or let's call it the ability to find the consumer where they are, because you can't advertise the way traditional companies advertise right now. So we like the multifaceted component of when you, let's say you land in a dispensary or you land at Denver Airport, not only are dispensaries gonna try to get on your radar, and based on, you know, your phone activity, you might have searched already, right? Obviously we have a very large investment in Leafly. That's all about understanding what is the future.
That's an ad vertical.
Yeah, the advertising ability, because advertising can't really be monetized till you have immense amounts of volume. And we're not there yet, but the ability to reach a consumer. So you land at a Denver airport, all the dispensaries want to communicate with you, but more importantly, so do all the brands. So when you get to a high volume where every brand is on, or brands have partnerships and they can be found in certain places, they're all going to be fighting to get in front of you. And that means ad click rates, everything goes higher. So it'll normalize at some point, but it's not going to be normal for 3 or 4 years. So that's why investments in MediaGel, New Frontier, Leafly. So, you know, when someone says, why are you in all these data companies? Because the future of the consumer, they haven't done anything online for their whole life. Thomas loves cannabis. How much online activity have you had in cannabis in your life? None, almost.
None.
You don't search it online. You might read some articles, but you're not looking at dispensaries and looking at their menus and interacting, the things that everyone else does. Yeah. Uber Eats.
And ordering online.
Yeah. Uber Eats is worth a tremendous amount of money, because why did Uber go into that? Because they want to know what people are eating. It allows them to make money off people's decision making, and that hasn't existed in cannabis yet, but it will.
Yeah.
It will. I mean, I don't know when.
Yeah.
But and the last thing I would just say is we believe deeply in the evolution of the digital desktop. As operators get more sophisticated, more automation, their reliance on tools that normalize their business from general ledger to ordering to what they're ordering, price improvement, their ability to communicate with bigger suppliers and do that in an organized fashion across so many, you know, different locations, we think is an incredible opportunity. And that's why we're heavily invested in ERP solutions. And again, that data, really understanding at the operational level what's happening, how people are ordering, why they're ordering. I mean, if someone orders, you know, 500 rolling benches and 150 lights, well, I guarantee you they're in a state that's growing pretty quickly. Or for them, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, understanding that relative growth factor allows us to always be one step ahead. And, you know, when you're a small, we have the joy at Merida of being able to be quote unquote big in an industry where no one's really that big, but in a world that has no true monster competition.
Yeah.
So you can do things in a unique way that are specific to cannabis that extrapolate to much bigger value downstream when this becomes a much bigger, you know, when there's 100 billion of legal cannabis consumed, think about where that is compared to the 25 billion right now. 75 billion, that's a long road.
Yeah.
A lot happens, a lot of automation, a lot of new innovation. And so to stay one step ahead isn't that hard yet. It's truly that unique place we're in right now, where information asymmetry, doing things like this where people can get information on whether it's commodities. You know, these are areas that people, commodities, energy, they have to learn more about the world now, because these are new areas. It isn't just like, I'm going to buy a Fang or, you know, I can make, you know, 2x my money in Tesla every year. So cannabis is one of those spaces where you really need research. And where do you get that research? I mean,
right,
you can only read, right, you can only read so many can or, you know, of the 8 or 9 banks that are really following this closely, their research is good. It's getting better every day. But the reality is there's still adjusting to the fact that they're judging something that they traditionally have not had. It's not like this is a company that they've run through the ringer a million times.
Yeah, it's
all new. Still new. So that's why we always talk about how the analytics around the industry are, they didn't mean nothing. 2 years from now, we could have a totally different metric, the way funded capacity mattered 2 years ago. Think about how far we are from that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's only 2.5 years ago.
Memory.
Yeah, but it's not. In the world, 2.5 years is almost nothing.
Yeah.
It's the blink of a cycle. So we try to be, we believe the long tail in cannabis is being able to see the future of normalization, institutional participation, medicalization, pharmaceuticalization, all of those things. And the only way to really do it is to talk to companies and find out what they're seeing on the front end, and then work very hard to see the horizon as well.
Mitch Berukowicz, Merida, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, guys. Yeah, my pleasure.
All right, we're excited to be joined by some energy specialists. You've all seen, you know, what's going on in the market. It's a lot of turmoil, but one bright spot has been energy, and there's a lot to unpack and understand. So we're joined by Lee Gehring and Adam Rosenzweig. They're both of GNR Associates. So Adam has been a longtime energy investor, Lee even more so. We're very excited to talk with you guys.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So I wanted to kick this off. You've seen a bunch of energy cycles. Is this different than the last few, say since 2000? Does this feel like this is shaping up differently?
I don't think so, in the sense that the basis of any bull market in energy or crisis is the fact that it's been characterized by underinvestment in the upstream business long before the crisis actually happens. And this case, the reason why this may be different this time is that the amount of cutback in upstream capital spending, or spending in the E&P, the whole energy industry in general, has fallen tremendously. Except this time, the mechanisms to make that, that would be put in place to make that capital investment rise, are not there, are actually being blocked. So there's a good chance that what happens in this cycle, and it's already these trends have already emerged, mm-hmm. in the sense that oil prices now are up, probably 150-200% off their bottoms if you take out that zero oil price experience we had back in April of 2020, and capital spending has hardly budged off the bottom yet. And you say, well, why is that? And that's because of a bunch of factors that are embedded in these markets, in the company that are bedeviling the companies that are operating in this market, that didn't exist back in the previous bull markets.
And you know, in any of these capital cycles, you get signals to the market that you're saying, we want more commodities, we want more capital spending, we want more upstream investment. And we've been getting all of those now for 2.5 years. And so I think a lot of people, particularly people new to this story, are looking at what happened in the Ukraine and what's happening with Russia, and they're saying, okay, this is why oil prices are higher. But you know, the truth of the matter is this crisis was in place before the Ukraine, and it's going to be in place for quite some time until you get that money spent again. And so if you look, you know, we've been calling it the sort of crisis that's been happening in slow motion, and it might seem like it's happening really quickly and out of control, but inventories peaked out April of 2020. They've been declining ever since on a seasonally adjusted basis. Prices have been moving higher. Energy stocks were the best performing sector in the S&P 500 last year. They're the best performing sector again. But to your point, you know, when you were talking about Cathie Wood not seeing any outflows, you're not seeing any material inflows into any of the energy stocks. You're not seeing any increase in capital spending, marginally, but nothing. You know, the market is screaming for more physical supply.
That's a very interesting point. That what's the mirror image of money not leaving Cathie? You're not necessarily seeing that flowing into energy in terms of, like, you know, massive buying in.
No, you're not seeing anything. And you know, last week all the poor energy companies were brought to Capitol Hill and brought before Congress. And you know, it wasn't 6 months ago that they were there again, and the same you know, Democratic congressmen were saying, you know, you ought to be ashamed of yourself because all your European counterparts are seeing production decline and you're seeing production be flat or slightly up, and aren't you ashamed of yourself? And now they're saying, you know, why haven't you produced more? So this is going to be a long trend that needs to be unwound, and a big part of psychology that needs to change.
Yeah,
we're just not seeing it yet.
Yeah, and I want to bring up two very important points that are going to make this cycle different than the previous cycles that we have, and probably cause it to really turn into just a one humdinger of a bull market. What on the supply side, one of the things that people think, and it's, you just read the press, everyone says, oh, companies, just take all your money and invest upstream and grow your production. Okay, let's go back over the last 10 years. Where has been near 100% of the growth in total global oil supply, or be more specifically, non-OPEC oil supply? Where has that growth come from? It's from the U.S. oil shales. There, outside the U.S. oil shales, there has been zero growth in non-OPEC total global oil supply. So I would say that it's safe to assume that future growth, unless we find some new source of oil that doesn't exist there today, that you know, past growth was all predicated upon the success of locking the oil in the U.S. shales, and everyone assumes that those shales can grow again. I can tell you that's not going to happen. You know, we model the shales probably more intensely than anyone else, and we believe that the shales have reached a point in their life where, you know, they've run out of top tier drilling inventory, production is plateauing right now, and in two of the three major shales has already begun a secular decline, and it will be impossible to grow oil supply from those shales again. And by definition, that's where all the oil supply growth came from. It will be very difficult to grow oil supply at all, even with a big, huge increase in upstream capital spending. That's one thing. The other thing is, everyone's talking about supply now, and the underinvestment supply, etc. But there's another factor at work here, which has brought this energy crisis upon us. And certainly we're talking about this in natural gas, because I know you guys are big natural gas investors. We're going to talk about that, because that's going to be the next great global crisis in energy. It's going to be the natural gas market here in the United States.
Right.
But the thing is that global demand has, you know, one of the reasons why we have this energy crisis is global demand is growing much, much faster than anyone ever anticipated. You know, you go back just a year ago, everyone said, we're going to look in retrospect, the 2019, that was the peak in all-time oil demand.
Right.
And from here on out, it's all downhill, because we're all going to be riding around in Teslas, and we're just going to stop consuming and things like that. And of course, none of that has happened. And there's also the fact that never before have there been so many people that are in there in emerging markets that have been in their intensive period of energy / oil consumption. Never before have there been so many people in history that exist that period today. So the thing is that all those people are energy hungry. They're not interested in buying Teslas, and so what's happened is oil consumption is surprised to the upside. It surprised the upside all last decade, every year. The IEA underestimated global oil demand from their original projections to their final estimations by almost 1 million barrels per year, every year between 2010 and up to last year. They revised up their 2021 demand estimate by 1 million barrels a day. I wouldn't be surprised when this decade is over, if supply is there, which it probably won't be, that we won't be, you know, we peaked out a little over 100 million barrels a day in 2019, in the fourth quarter. I wouldn't be surprised by 2030 that we're at close to 110 million barrels a day, or 150 million barrels a day. And so you've got this problem. You've got this embedded, very strong demand, and you've got a supply problem. Not only the capital spending, which has been inadequate, but you've got your biggest source of supply, which has been the shales. They're not going to grow this decade.
Oh, so there's a lot to unpack there. Maybe I'll just start with, you know, you guys, you dig in and you look at the rocks. So do you think, what are the chances that we find a new shale basin with what you know of the rocks in North America?
Well, in the United States, I think the chances are virtually nil. You know, there's a huge shale boom in the last decade, and a lot of exploration and a lot of development that has been successful and a lot of development that has not been successful. You know, even as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, there was talk of a few, albeit smaller, but sort of, you know, second generation shales. They've all proven to be geologically very, very difficult and technically very difficult. So I think the chance of finding more shale in the United States is basically zero.
So with how much exploration's already happened in the U.S., it's slim that they've missed something.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think if you look back when, you know, the Permian Basin, which is in West Texas, I mean, when that was hot in 2014, 2015, everyone, you could make, you know, huge amounts of money trying to promote the next shale, and you could make huge amounts of money buying land on a dollar per acres basis and try to get a good well somewhere in the vicinity. And, you know, things were floated, like the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale was a really hot trend a few years ago. They've all shown that that they really don't have the both the geological and then the geotechnical characteristics that would make for a good shale. So there's really nothing in the U.S. that I would say on the oil side is waiting in the wings as the next shale to be developed. What's interesting is a lot of people talk on a global basis because shale's an interesting rock. Shale's everywhere. It underlies all the conventional oil and gas reservoirs, and it's also present in a lot of places where there's no oil and gas reservoirs. So shale's a very common rock, and we have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands, or millions and millions of acres of shale around the world. The question is whether it's productive or not. And nobody has really tried to do the work. We have. We went back, this is a long time ago, probably starting 10 years ago, we started to ask all the management teams here in the U.S. what makes a really good shale. Things like thermal maturity and depth and thickness and clay content and silica, all the different things, organic matter. And we put together an index. You know, we tried to weight them all differently and whatever, and put together an index. And it turns out that the U.S. Geological Survey has compiled data of all the shales around the world in terms of how big they are and all these different properties. And so we looked at it and we said, you know, where is their good geological potential? And it might be surprising, but it turns out that 7 of the 10 best shales in the world are in the United States. What you need is you need a quiet inland sea. Basically what's been, you know, the depositional environment through the Eagle Ford, through the Permian, and even through the Bakken. So that's really kind of, that's it. You know, there's been a lot of places that have a lot of shale, a lot through Europe and whatever, and for whatever reason, whether there's too much clay content, which means that when you fracture that rock, it absorbs all the energy, it doesn't break and rubbleize the rock and free the oil, whether there just wasn't enough organic matter, whether it's been seismically active, so you have these big fault zones in places, so when you go to frack, all the energy just goes out, this major fracture in the rock, and doesn't get dissipated. But it turns out 7 of the 10 best are in the United States.
Wow, surprising. But so now, just going back to the supply, I'm wondering, you talked about there's a number of reasons why supply is not picking up when it usually does. Even the last cycle, it picked up pretty quickly. Can we talk maybe more about that and what you'd be watching for to see that things are changing and management teams are changing their idea of how much money they want to put to work?
Well, I think that the reason why we got such big supply responses in the last oil downturns, especially what happened after 2014 all the way down to 2016, is that in all the shales, including the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and the Permian, and the DJ Basin, that these companies still had a huge number of top-tier drilling locations in their acreage inventories. So they knew where they were. They says, okay, when I deploy that rig, I'm going to put it there, and I know I'm going to get 1,000 barrels a day BOE of hydrocarbon production out of that well. And so there was these huge drilling booms that concentrated on their top-tier acreage. The problem now is that top-tier acreage in the Eagle Ford and the Bakken is almost 100% gone, and there's some parts of it are still left in the Permian, but it's some parts of the Permian are significantly it's decreased as far as the top tier acreage. So you can't move those rigs there and get top tier, you know, drilling results. So, you know, I think that one of the reasons why the companies have been very, very reluctant to grow is that you know, the economics of drilling these second tier wells are vastly degraded versus the first tier wells.
There's much more risk in putting that capital
to
work.
Yeah, it's like a lot more risk because you need a much higher price. And, you know, think about this way. I drill that one well, I get 1,000 BOD a day, I recover a million barrels of oil, and that well cost me $8 million. In a two-tier prospect, that well still cost me $8 million. It produces 500 barrels of oil a day. It only recovers 500,000 barrels a day of oil. So I need a much higher oil price to get my capital back and give me a rate of return. So, you know, you've got to have people really comfortable with a world of 100 plus oil to develop all these second tier acreage.
Sweetly on that point, and you, last time we had the interview was fantastic. Just articulating, what should we expect as the new normal? Like, you know, all of these issues where we don't have the quality basins anymore. There's not shale anywhere other than America. Like, what should we think of should be the new kind of resting point? Or what's the incentive price to get these barrels on for these emerging market countries that are at their peak of growth?
Thomas, that's a difficult question. I'm going to give it to Adam.
Look, I think it's moved higher, and I think it's probably in a band, and it is a tough question to really narrow down. I think that if you removed all the capital constraints, and I think if you removed all the ESG pressures, which we haven't talked about, and we'll talk about here, and if you knew that oil was going to be set and stable at $80 a barrel, and you could incentivize, you know, offshore drilling platforms to go and make some discoveries and put some money to work on the exploration side, you could incentivize some production in Canada, I bet you could probably make the market balance somewhere in that $80 to $90 if everything were nice and smooth and stable.
Got it.
But, and here's the big rub, and we've been talking about sort of how to articulate it. That's really to generate a 10% IRR. That's always been kind of the round number economics in the oil business.
Yeah, yeah.
And that cost of capital is just not there anymore because of the ESG pressures, because of the volatility, because of the idea and the perception that the energy companies have destroyed value in the last cycle.
That's right.
Because no one's putting money to work, even though the market is signaling it to. I think the real cost of capital is probably closer to 20%. And in that band, I think that has moved up. And I think you're probably $125 a barrel. And whether that's permanent or not will be the big question. But for right now, in the foreseeable future, I think that's probably where it has to go.
That's a fantastic visualization. So I think 10%, you add another 20, I'm arbitrarily saying 50%. 50% of that extra 10 is ESG. And the other 50% is penalizing management teams from the last... Right, like
you have this
new kind of new reality, and arguably maybe the management thing, you know, can come back down a bit.
Well, the whole management destroying value is really interesting because, you know, there was clearly a lot of it's the oil business, and so when prices are high and money is available, people do things, and so I'm not going to say that there wasn't any value destruction. But I think if you really look back, a lot of what people labeled as value destruction was really the idea that the oil price went from 100 to 40, and everyone had planned in their budget that maybe it would stay 75. But, you know, it got really quite low. And I'm talking before COVID. I'm talking 14 to 16.
Yeah.
It bottomed in 2016 at $27 a barrel. And everyone said, look how these companies have destroyed value. But, I mean, I can't think of many industries where your average selling price drops from 100 to 27. And the business looks good.
Yeah, in their defense, they were looking, their decks were looking for declines in oil prices. They weren't saying it's going to stay this high forever or go higher.
Right. Yeah, I think the companies made big mistakes, not in that their original capital investment plans, because those wells that they drilled returned a lot of shareholder value if oil stayed at $75. But the problem, oil didn't stay at $75. And that's the mistake they made. It wasn't something that they didn't understand the geology or the engineering of what they were doing. They just misread the product price that they were going to get.
So as we think of ESG just on the ground, how it's affected things, you think it's mainly, it's raised the cost of capital. So if these guys want to raise money now versus 6 years ago, they just need better wells to make the money work if they're going to borrow.
I don't really know that the money, as of right now, I would say the money's just not available.
It's not
available.
You take
a company and, you know, we own this in our mutual fund in our account, but like Pioneer Natural Resources, and, you know, incredibly well run, you know, considered sort of a bellwether of the high quality Permian Basin names, and that's on track to do, you know, 20% plus free cash flow yield next year. So what does it take to get investors interested in a name like Pioneer? I'm not sure, but I would say that really there's almost, as of right now, there's still nothing. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see, I suppose.
I wonder, what is it telling us when we see these free cash flow yields and you see that money is not leaving an arc and going into energy? What are the investors, you know, what's going to get them moving? Is it this, that at the point right now, is it telling us they don't believe that oil prices are going to stay where they are?
Well, I've said I don't really care what they believe, because I know that's going to change. Mm-hmm. And I think that for investors in the energy space, you've been given the most incredible setup, even after this big run that's happened over the last year and a half in energy prices, in the sense that the energy, all energy markets, not all, but, you know, the oil and gas markets on a global basis are going to be in structural deficit, probably between now and the end of this decade. And the valuation of these equities that are in the space are ridiculously low, and that will be corrected. You know, that will go away. So if there's disinterest now, I guarantee that in 3 to 4 years, that investors will be clamoring to buy these stocks.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. Just a good example: Barron's this weekend, they had a big special insert in there about how to protect yourself against inflation. And in that, they listed 12 funds, of which four were bond funds. I like that. Four bond funds, four big cap equity funds, which probably own FANG stocks and things like that, and then four specialized commodity funds. There was not a natural resource equity specialized portfolio in there. I guarantee they come around.
They were just highlighting like a natural, like a commodity, like a just a pure commodity.
Like for example, somebody has an ETF that mimics the Goldman Sachs commodity index.
Got it.
Which of course is a, over the last 20 years, do you know what the return on that has been? It's been severely negative.
Yeah.
And for the, because you have to bear the cost of the role mm-hmm. when you buy that.
which is people don't understand. They don't understand how this works, right?
You can't get the spot. You invest in commodities, you can't get the spot prices. You have to buy the futures prices.
Yeah.
Or buy the actual commodity, which is the same as the futures price. It's the cost of doing that. So of that, there are four funds. I guarantee that in 2000, between 2025 and 2028, they'll write an article like there. There won't be one bond fund on there. There won't be one big general. It's not going to be all, you know, four specialized in inflation products and six commodity natural resource funds. But you have a long way to go, and the disinterest. The disinterest is what's made this area so exciting because investors can get in now and still get phenomenal returns.
Yeah. And you know, to put it all in perspective, how much the disinterest is still there. Energy as a percent of the S&P 500 has averaged about 13% over 40 plus 50 years. It got as high as 30% of the S&P 500 in 1980.
Right.
It was 1.8% in 2018. That was the low. It was the all-time low in history.
Right. Wow.
It's like 3.1% now. So it basically needs to triple to get back to its long-term average. And you know, it's very unlikely that markets go from being radically undervalued to spot on average properly fair value. They tend to overshoot on both sides. And certainly everyone can see that they overshot on the downside, hopefully. 1.7% of the S&P seems probably low in retrospect all energy, including natural gas and oil. And we're going to shoot to the upside. And it's going to be a speculative mania when it's over. So people say, well, have I missed it yet? And you look, I mean, you're not even close to back to average.
No. Yeah, and very much like, at least from a retail perspective, and when you think of advisors, it just, the lexicon of natural resources just isn't there anymore, right? And they keep coming back to the mirror image of that is how big tech was at probably 2018, right? Like mm-hmm. almost.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, this cycle's evolving a little bit differently than the previous big commodity bottom, which occurred back in 1999 to about 2001. In the sense that the dot-com bubble broke in May of 2000, and that's when natural resource stocks started to really outperform. And we haven't, other than the last two, three months, we haven't had a real breaking of the tech bubble yet. And the thing is that's gonna happen in the next 6 months or so, and that's when you're gonna see, because people will start to sell, and they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm selling here, where do I redeploy my capital? And they'll say, into this area it goes.
So the green on the board will be the commodity, exactly.
Which has been year to date, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it really has been the one.
I said, the disinterest and the lack of capital flows is what makes this thing so exciting, because you've been given the roadmap going forward of what's going to happen this decade, and what are going to be the great outperforming investments, and no one has taken advantage of it yet.
Yeah, and so. You guys are talking to people all the time, and you've talked to people in past cycles, and so you see that it's different. The apathy is palpable.
Yeah, and I think it is because last year the S&P 500, which is basically FANG dominated, I think was up 26 or 27%. So you know the average energy stock was up 60%. But you know people said, well, I did really well in the S&P. What happens when all of a sudden the average energy stock is up 60% and the S&P is down 25%? Then people start to think differently. Mm-hmm. So.
Maybe we could switch gears to gas for a bit. And you know, for us, a big part of the gas driver is LNG, liquefied natural gas. Just from that perspective, do you expect the U.S. can be a low-cost supplier to the world in gas?
I want to talk about gas because one of the things that, you know, last time I did your podcast, I hope you got an idea that, and I may mention this, you know, Gary and Rose's why, we don't tell you what happened today or happened yesterday or how we got here today. We'll tell you, here we are today, this is where we're going to go into the future. And that, I tell you, that is incredibly hard to do. And most people don't do it because it's fraught with peril. You can be wrong, you can be embarrassed, you can be dragged out in the financial press and said, called a, you know, an idiot. And but you know, one of the things we really try to do is we try to look into the future. Now, here's a classic example of this. Now, it's fraught with risk. Global natural gas prices are basically $35 MCF today. What's the price here in the U.S.? It's broken through six.
Six and change
right now.
Still single digits.
Yes. What if I were to tell you that at some point between now and year-end 2022, that in a period of 2 weeks, that $6 price converges with the $35 international price? That is the next leg of the great energy crisis,
right?
On a global basis, this global energy crisis started with natural gas, and we can talk all the reasons why that it started in natural gas.
Yes.
Some of which we did not predict. We talked all about the strength of global natural gas, and we were radically underestimating the strength of that demand. But we didn't think it was going to start natural gas, but it did. And it's interesting that the next big crisis is going to happen where the U.S. price converges with the international price.
Could you expand on why you think that timeline is when it happens, given LNG, the timing of new demand?
It's very, very interesting, and you know, people aren't talking about this. Historically, the U.S. natural gas market has had a unique structure, and that structure is it's been basically structured as an island.
Yes.
For example, gas that was produced in Canada and the U.S. could never get out.
Yeah,
you know, you could import gas in. You know, remember the U.S. used to be one of the world's largest importer of LNG up to 2007, 2008. We peaked out at like 2.1 Bs a day of LNG imports.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And so gas could get in, but gas could never ever get out. It was trapped. So what happened on global gas markets didn't have much effect on the U.S. gas market. It just because there was no way to interconnect those markets. However, how the world has changed. Since 2016, the U.S. has gone from producing zero exportable LNG to being the world's largest LNG exporter today.
Yeah.
At the end of this year, we're going to be able to export 13 Bs a day of LNG, which is 30% more than Qatar and Australia.
Yeah, impressive.
The two. That's incredible. Okay, so now we're fully connected into the global gas market for the first time ever, but we're still completely disconnected in price, 35 versus 6. Why is that? Well, from 2010 to 2021 is basically been the second leg of the great shale gas revolution, which started all the way back in the early 2000s with the discovery of the Barnett and the Fayetteville. And then comes late 2000s is the discovery of the Haynesville and the Marcellus. And the Marcellus and Haynesville went from zero to 25 Bs a day, 11 Bs a day, 10 Bs a day, incredible growth. And so even with all that LNG export demand coming online, the U.S. gas market has stayed in structural surplus. And you know, and it's interesting, no one knows this, that there's three fields in the United States that are producing 50% of the gas today. Never before has gas production been concentrated in just such a small number of reservoirs. And our belief is that both the Marcellus and the Haynesville are getting closer to plateauing and then declining.
Like other oil basins.
Like oil basins.
Got
and
it.
Just, you know, if for your listeners, please go back if you can, and these charts will be in our letters coming up,
yeah.
Is that can these fields decline? Oh, yes, they can. They are susceptible to you know, long-term understood geological factors. For example, the Barnett was discovered. Discovery is not the right word. We always knew the gas was there. We just couldn't figure out how to get it out. We discovered those fields, Barnett, back in the early 2000s. It went from zero to over 5 Bs a day of production by 2011, plateaued, and today that production of the Barnett is down 60% from its peak. And at the peak, the Barnett had 180 drilling rigs operating on it. Today it has 3. That field, it just, tier one acreage was exhausted.
Right.
And so everyone's just basically left it behind. And the Fayetteville, the second great gas field to be discovered back in 2005 by Southwestern Energy, it went from zero to over 3 Bs a day, 2005 to 2011, and it's declined 60% today. And the Fayetteville has zero rigs drilling on it today. The same thing's going to happen with the Haynesville.
And we have a price that that should induce
it. Yes,
right?
See, this is the classic case. When you run out of Tier 1 inventory, you don't want to go back. I mean, Tier 2 inventory is unsatisfactory. It just doesn't get you the rates of return. It's still expensive to drill those wells. Yeah. You don't get a lot of gas out of it. So the thing is that the same thing that happened to those two fields is going to happen to the Marcellus and the Haynesville.
Yeah.
So the thing is, we're getting closer and closer. We may not be there yet, but we're getting awfully close. The day that all of a sudden investors in the global gas community says, uh-oh, the U.S. market is switching from structural supply to structural deficit, the gas price is gonna converge like that.
Right.
And
so it's not like some sort of gradual, like...
No.
No.
Right, it's just, you guys see it as a... It's just the...
But in the meantime, isn't there a huge opportunity for U.S. LNG? Because as every individual bid that they put on, they can undercut the rest of the world while prices
absolutely.
Stay like this.
That's in fact, you know, there's the Sabine Pass expansion. There's a big LNG new facility coming online right now, and that's going to add close to 2.5 Bs a day of demand this year alone. Now it does. There's not much coming on between now and 2015, but the funny thing is that we have this huge demand for LNG. We have this $35 price. We have a $6 gas price here. That gas is. You're going to buy all that gas you can to get it out.
Yeah.
But you're going to get what happens when that gas, all of a sudden, like I said, we switch from structural supply to structural deficit.
It's going
to
be
surplus.
Violent.
Violent.
Yeah.
It could happen. And we don't know. It's a function of weather. We could have a brutally hot summer. We could have a really cold start to the fall. We go with inventories very, very low in the market. And... it could happen then.
And what's interesting is, prices now are behaving very strange in the sense they're very strong in a period of time that they should be very, very weak in the shoulder season. And inventories are far below normal, here in the United States. So I think we're tightening as we speak.
And one thing we haven't touched on, this is the backdrop. Also, what if, thinking about the global price, European, just how do we factor in Russia into this equation and potential, if Germany just says no, and what did they do? I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, what if the pressure, as Chris was saying, the pressure is so significant, they have to shut it off. What outlets do they have? And maybe it's a broader question around power. Is it natural gas? Like, what
or
do you do?
Engineering-wise,
yeah,
what options
it's a good
they
point
have.
To touch on.
First, we're going to go backwards. We're going to burn wood. I mean, I'm not joking. That's happening in Germany. There's a big Bloomberg story. The people, the German consumers burning wood to heat their homes.
Oh, wow.
And so the thing is, what you're going to do is there's only one short-term solution, and that's burn a lot of extra coal.
Right.
And the thing is that this is I'd love to talk on another podcast someday about the renewables and how the renewables have been hugely responsible for the energy crisis in Europe.
Yeah.
And,
do you know what, just throwing it out there, what we should do? Let's do a real nice special on that, where we actually delve into this. We'll bring graphics into it.
Oh, yeah.
Bring it to life, because this is the big, there's a big story there, but we can save that.
We did a podcast not too long ago. Adam was a speaker at the Alpine Macro Conference, and he presented the terrible energy efficiency of renewables, and he put it in a historical perspective, going all the way back to 2,000 years. And back to the wood thing, it's fascinating. It turns out that the energy efficiency of many renewables is the same as burning wood. It's not coincidental that in Europe they're burning
just a
wood,
fancier package.
They're burning, everyone's going out and buying stoves and putting burning wood pellets in their house. And so the thing is that we have all this anecdotal evidence that all the research we've done on this is true, but again, it's a whole subject, interesting subject for another day.
Yeah,
it's
but
gonna
no,
take time.
I mean, for example, the big problem in the energy crisis is Germany. Germany They were generating 25% of their electricity with nuclear power. As far as energy efficiency, there is no way to generate electricity with more energy efficiency than with nuclear power. It's off the charts. So you close that and you replace it with wind and solar, which is terrible. So is it any coincidence that the energy crisis started in Germany?
Right.
Close all that incredibly efficient energy electricity generating capability, replace it with a terribly efficient generating capability, you're going to have a crisis.
And gas is the only thing holding the whole thing together.
Yeah. Well, here's something interesting. We have to wait for the BP statistical numbers to come out in June, but we're going to find out that Europe in 2021 made an all-time new high in coal consumption.
Huh.
Basically wiped out an entire decade of trying to reduce CO2.
How's that carbon trading gone?
Like, no, exactly. Right? Like, exactly.
Like, it's the, if we're there, like it, then the whole thing has been a...
It's been a waste of time.
It's a
waste of $1.5 trillion. And the problem with renewables is their energy efficiency is so bad that what happens is that the economy can't grow. Because
that's
so,
the energy return on energy invested.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It can't grow.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's got to shrink because it's so expensive to maintain these systems. And that's what you're seeing in Europe right now. You're seeing Europe. It's manifesting itself in super high energy costs, but that's how you'll take out the growth in the economy is through high energy prices.
You know, maybe we should tie things up with just asking you guys what your favorite part of the energy market is, say over the next 12 months. Is it oil? Is it gas? Is it uranium? If you had to rank it,
and maybe broader, just obviously because you guys have the mutual fund, like how do you guys think about strategy and then fitting
well,
into?
I think Adam will talk about uranium because I think that's one of the more interesting, exciting things because we're very close to an explosion, I think, in uranium prices.
Bad. Poor choice of words. but a strong rally in uranium.
A strong rally. A committed rally.
An upturn.
Look, you know, I think, first of all, we're positioned. We own, you know, fairly material positions in both natural gas stocks and oil stocks. Again, we've been bullish on oil and natural gas for a few years now. It's been predicated on the idea of chronic underspending and the idea that the cycle isn't being allowed to work itself because of ESG pressure. So you're sending all the signals out to the market, you're not getting the response you want back. Likely alluded to before, we would have thought it would have shown up first in oil markets and then spilled over into gas. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's coming the opposite way. So we're extremely bullish on both oil and natural gas. I think probably, I don't know, hard to say, but maybe there could be some more dramatic news headlines in the next 12 months on the gas side of things, just if the thesis that Lee was talking about does come. But, you know, uranium is incredibly, and we're also very, very bullish on uranium. And so when you look at any fuel source and you look at the energy efficiency, which I think is critical to its long-term viability, and then you look at its carbon emissions, which is we're clearly becoming more and more sensitive to on a global basis, everything is basically a trade-off. So you have coal, you have natural gas, you have oil. You know, natural gas we like because it's the same energy efficiency as coal with half the CO2. Now the problem right now is we don't have enough natural gas, so coal is coming back into the mix big time, and that could be an interesting investment idea as well. We don't have any exposure. But uranium is the only fuel source that is seriously off the charts. It's like the efficient frontier. Everything else you're trading off risk and return. This just sits above. It has, you know, coal and natural gas and oil, basically 30-1 energy return on energy invested. Every unit in, you get 30 units out. Renewables, once you factor in the redundancy that you need and the battery backups, you're basically between 5 and 10-1 on your best renewables.
Yeah.
Not dissimilar from biomass that we used for 17 centuries before the Industrial Revolution. Uranium's 100-1. So it's a similar, you could see almost a similar uptick moving from hydrocarbons to uranium that you saw moving from biomass to hydrocarbons in the 17th century, with huge amounts of growth behind it. So we think that, you know, longer term, that's probably the most exciting. And people now, for the first time in a decade, are becoming more and more favorably disposed to nuclear power.
So there was a good there was a Twitter thread going around just, but you know, I covered U.S. utilities and just what is the challenge for American utilities to build nuclear plants on time, on budget. We have two financial disasters in the last two nuclear plants,
sure,
in America versus China, which is, you know, or like its assembly plant out there.
Mm-hmm.
What, like, is it like, I'm just, obviously there's the element of regulation, but what beyond that is, or like, what is American utilities missing that obviously Chinese utilities can pull at it, just getting it done?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really interesting question, and I think there's a some sort of problem, not just in the nuclear utility, nuclear power plant building, but in America general, building huge infrastructure projects. I mean, right here, the Second Avenue subway, I believe it cost 2.5 times its original cost. Same thing the nuclear power plant would go through. So I don't know how you fix that.
Yeah.
But see, what's interesting about it is that nuclear power plants are generating electricity from uranium is so efficient. It really doesn't matter how much you go over cost. Because what you're going to do, these plants can last 50 to 100 years. And the funny thing is you amortize that cost over the entire plant. Well, let's do that because that's good for, you know, it's produces no CO2, things like that. So as an investor, let's do that. And all of a sudden, it's not so expensive. And so whether it costs $15 billion or $7 billion, it really doesn't make any difference. And it's all free of CO2. So we're just going to have to get over that. I don't know what, someday maybe as a society we'll fix that problem, just like we can't build a Second Avenue subway line here in New York City.
We can't
build a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, it's
the same problem.
And a lot of things that people are excited about now on the nuclear side are these small modular reactors.
Sure, yeah.
Which I have to admit, we haven't done a lot of work. You know, there's two private companies that are working on them. There seems to be a lot of hope, and the idea would be, because this is a problem with nuclear reactors, is that everything tends to be large projects, and so you don't get a lot of economies of scale. Everything's sort of bespoke. I mean, there's obviously certain elements to it can be modularized and systematized, but these small modular reactors, the hope with them is that you can get manufacturing costs down by just kind of stamping them out. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Energy's never really worked that way. You've never made more efficient products and energy by going smaller. Energy tends to get economies of scale by growing bigger.
Yeah,
so we have these huge power plants, these massive offshore drilling rigs, whatever.
Maybe they're like, we think of them like if they can kind of get them assembly plant, like nuclear power plants become batteries, right? Where you know, effectively it's, you know, more or less, right? You know, like there has to be that where you skirt the... Because a big part of this, obviously, is regulatory, right?
Oh, sure, yes.
Right, and then there's obviously the construction, but there's probably some hand-in-hand there, right? Which explains why China can do it.
Yeah, and the last big problem with these plants that you're mentioning, Thomas, is that, you know, they were started construction not too far after Fukushima, which, you know, they were basically, they were supposed to be built as off-the-shelf plants. And after Fukushima, they said, no, you have to do this, no, you have to do that, you have to change this, you have to do that. And of course, both of them went 100% over capital cost budget right away on that. So,
but, you know, I think we're moving, unfortunately, in some ways, in the wrong direction. You know, there's a cottage industry that's developed that makes a lot of money from decommissioning nuclear power plants. and a lot of these nuclear power plants, believe it or not, have, you know, reclamation funds associated with them that are overfunded, probably the only overfunded funds in the whole United States are the nuclear decommissioning cost funds. So there's a cottage industry and a huge amount of money where you could, you know, buy these things, you know, lobby for them to be shut down, buy them and dismantle them. That's what happened in Indian Point. That's what's happening in California.
Of course, right. Yeah.
Wow, well, this has been fascinating. I think we definitely need to keep the conversation going because this is a fast-moving industry and it's an exciting time to be an energy investor, I believe.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And like I said, this bull market's only started. And it'd be fascinating to come around and sit around this table in 2028 and see how different the world looks than it does today. But it's going to look different today.
Yeah. Well, Lee and Adam from GNR, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.